You're playing as the world's most competent engineer, aren't you? Whose name is Engineer?
Yeah, it's and actually, do you know what? Like you were saying about, like, say, Dragon's Dogma, for instance, not caring about that sort of showiness. Mm. It's not a show, like, there's no emotion about the fact, like, you have these little lines of dialogue that agonizingly show up in the bottom left corner of a screen where he's like, I guess all of my close friends are dead, so time for me to move on. And it's really, it's like, I imagine the guy has no social skills. There's no emotion.
Become a Patreon supporter today to get access to exclusive bonus content. Comedian Glenn Moore and I discussing the game of the month that the listeners of My Perfect Console have been playing through. Head to patreon.com/myperfectconsole.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
My guest today is a San Francisco-based writer and senior editor at the video game publication PC Gamer. Having graduated from the University of Georgia with a degree in journalism and magazines, my guest freelanced for The Wirecutter, the product review website now owned by the New York Times, and Tested.com, where he reviewed and recommended PC hardware. In January 2014, he joined PC Gamer magazine as features and hardware editor. There, he has written dozens of investigative pieces highlighting specific video game communities, publishing stories of how video games affect our lives and culture, and revealing how games and the hardware they run on are made. He is also the author of Read Only Memo, a newsletter all about video game emulation. Welcome, Wes Fenlon.
Jeez, thank you, Simon. I feel like I'm in the beginning of Tar here, like I'm on stage, the New Yorker introducing me. All very dramatic. Yeah, lovely to be here.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for doing this. I was just, before we start recording, commenting on your lovely apartment. So you're in San Francisco, which I can see on the video for listeners, by the way. We're not together, but you're in San Francisco, right?
You're welcome anytime. But yeah, I've lived here for over 11 years now. I moved about a year after I finished with university, did a few years in San Francisco as a barely breaking even freelancer, which no complaints. That was a cool life. But it is nice to have a steady job and be able to afford an apartment.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, everyone listening to this will know about PC Gamer, even if they don't read it regularly. But why don't you give us the sort of like pitch of, I suppose, why people visit PC Gamer? And obviously, it's one of the largest PC games focused magazines and websites in the world. So,
yeah, I mean, we have kind of vanishingly few legacy brands, I think, left in media that have a real significance to people, especially in the games media, right, where many of the magazines, you know, from the 90s or 2000s are gone. A lot of the gaming sites, even from the 2000s or 2010s, have vanished. So, you know, there's still plenty of longstanding ones out there, you know, Eurogamer and IGN and the like, but not as many as there were just even a few years ago. And yeah, the website has grown enormously since I've been there, for kind of tugging at my collar, feeling my age for more than nine years now. But when I started, sort of ironically, for a website called PC Gamer, the internet was sort of this new concept for future our publishing company. Simon, I know you did plenty of writing for Edge back in the day. Future was very slow to embrace online publishing. It was really like sticking it out in the magazine business. So PC Gamer had a web presence for a long time, but it was very, very small. So around the time when I joined in 2014, we were really only a few years into it being kind of a proper gaming site with a staff of people working on the website. And now we have close to 30 people, I think, across the world working on the site, you know, across news, guides, features, hardware. So it's quite a big production these days.
Yeah, I mean, it's an enormous website. I was looking at some of your, I mean, these are the public figures for impressions. I don't know how accurate they are, but the website I was on recommend the last 3 months, you've had 26 million impressions on the website. That's even if those aren't all unique people, that's a lot of clicks. And a quarter of your audience is based in the US and three quarters is around the world. So I assume the site makes its money from advertising. What sort of stories bring in the most traffic?
I mean, for us, on a good day, we can have a million people come to the site. So it's crazy for me compared to where we started, you know, many, many more people. But they'll come from all over the place. We still have a decent number of people who just come to the homepage to, you know, like, I think we're blessed by having a very easy URL to type in and remember, you know, pcgamer.com. Like, you're not going to forget that. But I think a lot of people just come to, you know, check what's new on the site. But by and large, our traffic comes from kind of that weird, mysterious mix of sources through things that occasionally pop up on Reddit and go big, things that we post to Facebook that blow up, Google search, as well as Google Discover, which is their kind of like algorithmic feed that you'll see on your Android phone if you have an Android, or if you use like the Google app on iOS, it'll kind of give you recommended stories, as well as the kind of like the news boxes. If you search, you know, I don't know, if you search Starfield, right, on Google, it'll kind of pop up some news stories from websites as well as whatever the search results are. So a lot of it comes to us through people Googling stuff or getting stuff from that feed. So news really drives the most interest to the site. But when there's a big game out, people will come for the review. Some games will drive a lot of interesting guides. You know, Elden Ring was a game that for a good 2 months, people were just insatiable for guidance for playing that game.
Elden Ring paid the bills of loads of games journalists around the world.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's kind of all over the place, which is exciting, but also scary, because you never know when, you know, an algorithmic shift is just going to mean like all of a sudden 500,000 fewer people like come to the site in a given month or something. And you're like, why did that happen?
Right.
Did we do something wrong? No, we have no idea.
Someone at Google fell asleep on their keyboard and the algorithm changed.
Yep. They just put a backslash in the wrong place. And all of a sudden we're like all in panic mode. Yeah. Unfortunately, too real.
I had a guest on, Dan Vaquito, one of the creators of Trombone Champ. That was a game that went viral last year. And it was, he put it down to PC Gamer doing a tweet about the game and, you know, got however many millions of people viewed it. And that led to loads of direct sales. And I suppose there's a sense that PC Gamer is one of the few places that has that ability to also that kingmaker touch, right? Where if it's the right game that you highlight, you can make a big star of it. Do you feel that? Do you feel that power? And when was the last time you saw something like that happen, you have a discernible effect on a game's fate.
Yeah, I mean, me personally, not too often, I don't think. I also tend to kind of selfishly have an interest often in slightly weirder games or, you know, older stuff or things that are like a little bit off the sort of what's hot index. I was certainly writing a lot about Elden Ring, but that was a game that did not need my impact at all to become a king, right? But it is really, it feels really good to see indie games have that kind of success because of a really positive review or just us kind of making people aware that it exists. But one of the challenges, I think, of running or working on a gaming site in this era is how much we're sort of taste makers and how much we're kind of putting our finger in the air and trying to get a sense of where people's interest is and chasing that up. It's a good example of that called Dave the Diver. It's a small indie game, mixes in all these kind of different game systems where at first you're kind of fishing and diving and like creating your little ocean restaurant, and then it keeps adding more and more layers to it. And we were not like the people who discovered this game by any means, but it kind of was in early access for a while and had fans, but was sort of under the surface. And then once the full release came out, we saw some more people talking about it. We were like, we should take a deeper look at this. And all of a sudden we were like, oh, this is one of the best games of the year. And like, we need to write, you know, tons of stuff about this game. So it's always kind of a funky balance of trying to, you know, stay ahead of the curve, but also be writing about stuff we know people are interested in. But the most gratifying stuff for me is when I write about people doing like fan translations or hacks of games or something that's sort of that I think is kind of underappreciated, and their followings can often be so small that just shining a light on them and having, you know, a few thousand people learn about them can make a huge difference.
And then what are some of the big challenges that you're facing right now in the world of PC gamer, you know, as I suppose, you know, as a trying to remain relevant and remain popular and all that stuff. It's obviously a big topic, no matter what kind of publication you are. But what's the thing that you guys are discussing at the moment for what you need to be on top of?
Something we've focused more and more on in our coverage of this big stuff that people are excited about is not just writing the news that everybody else is writing, not just doing a review like everybody else is doing, but writing stuff when we have something to say about a trailer for a new game, a new press release. You know, sometimes it's frustrating when a developer kind of comes out and they say sort of a load of nothing about their new game coming out, right? I'm sure you've had plenty of those interviews where you're hoping that they'll tell you about the creative process and they give you nothing, right?
Never. I've never had one of those.
Right. You're just operating at such a pro level. You always get something good out of them. No,
of course. Yeah. Yeah. I've often been in that situation.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, even a couple times we've sort of taken that and made the story, wow, we were excited about this game, but we sure wish they would say something, and actually making that the headline, you know, and not sort of doing it antagonistically, but just doing it as a way to express what we're feeling and what other people are probably feeling, but not necessarily writing on their website, right? They're just sort of throwing up the trailer, throwing up the kind of nothing bit of news and moving on to the next thing. And so it's kind of a constant process of not letting ourselves get too comfortable with doing things the exact same way we're doing it, or kind of taking for granted what's out there and working with that and going like, no, we can hit this from a different angle. We can express what's in the air that people are thinking about, or give them an opinion that maybe they haven't thought about, and just try to make it as much our perspective as we can. I think that's kind of the only way you can survive as a big site in the era of just so many news sources, so many influencers on YouTube and other platforms, on Twitch, you know, kind of drawing people to them for their personalities. There's more noise than ever, and you can't just be another element of noise. You have to have some kind of unique...
Gotta have an angle,
yeah. I mean, and that's sort of like journalism back to the beginning of time, right? But I think it's the way you find that angle and express that angle is always going to be different every few years. So you've always just kind of got to stay limber.
One thing I'm interested in is many of the big sites, and I would definitely class PC Gamer in this, sort of straddle this, you know, you're both doing serious criticism. And, you know, when you review a game, it's not just going, oh, you know, I give the graphics 60% or whatever. It's right. Not going through it in that like product way. You're trying to do serious criticism. But you're also, as you were describing there, engaged in, you know, a little bit in the marketing cycle leading up to these games' releases. And sometimes that can just be a really jarring gear change for readers, right? When for 4 months they've been reading on IGN or PC Gamer about how great Starfield's going to be or how interesting it is. And then your reviewer comes out and goes, oh, all these things are sort of failures. And then suddenly you've got a massive internet tantrum right. on your hands. How do you what's your take on all of that? That slight tension, I suppose, in the work.
Yeah, I think it's always going to exist to some extent. I'd say we don't write nearly as many kind of traditional previews as we probably once did. We're kind of less likely to go just play a really early version of a game at an event that is a very curated, you know, way for the developer to present it, as we would have done 5, certainly 10 years ago, where that was sort of a bread and butter element of games. And we still do those for sure in games we're interested in. But I think we tend to write them much more often now if it's a game we legitimately are interested in already and excited about. And I think we also maybe aren't quite as forgiving as we would have been, again, 10 years ago from a game that's early in development. I think we have kind of a stronger sense of whether a game's going to make it, you know, when you play it early, even if it's a year away, you can probably see the warning signs, right? And I think games being in early access now has given us a lot more perspective on kind of how far away from release a game you can play it and sort of see whether it's going to come together or not. But yeah, I mean, there's always anger on the internet. Like, that's always a risk. It is something that unfortunately comes up in discussions of who's going to review something, or sort of what bracing we may have to do for the experience of, you know, something getting published.
Who's going to tank this week, this month?
Exactly. Yeah.
Right, Wes, I've asked you to pick the 5 video games you'd like to put on your ideal fictional games machine. Really looking forward to chatting through the 5 that you've picked. So why don't you tell us about your first pick, which comes from 1987, or at least that's when it started. What's this game and why did you love it?
This game is NetHack. It is a roguelike RPG dungeon crawler, yeah, from 1987.
So tell us, yeah, how did you encounter this game and what did you do in it, I guess, is the first point.
So if anyone who listens to this podcast who knows much about or anything about video games, you've probably heard the term roguelike at some point. They're extremely popular games now. They largely revolve around procedural generation of something like a dungeon that you're going through, where it's going to be random and different every time you play it. Usually they revolve around permadeath, where when your character dies, you got to go back to the beginning, start from square one. There are now many games that are roguelites, which kind of give you some more like meta progression over time, right? Where you get a little bit stronger and it becomes easier to reach the end of the game. Greg Kasavin's Hades is a good example. I know you had him on the podcast earlier. So all of those games descended from a game called Rogue, which was the original Rogue, you know, no like from 1980. And then there were some descendants of that game, people kind of recreating it. One was called Hack that came out, I think, in 1984, maybe 1983, somewhere in there, that was just made by a bunch of like high school or college students. This was, you know, at the time in the early 80s, not many people had personal computers. We did not have the internet. We did have some kind of early networks, right, between universities and schools. So a lot of the people making games and playing games back then on computers were students or professors. And so a lot of game development kind of came out of people playing these games, talking about them on early message boards, and then just like making hacks of them or modifications of them. So NetHack was kind of born out of that lineage. It's basically this, you know, simple ASCII graphics. Everything is done with letters and symbols from, you know, from your keyboard to create these random dungeons that you can go deep and explore. And you're trying to collect the amulet of Yendor, which is kind of the original MacGuffin for video games. These early games kind of set the template of going through a dungeon, fighting monsters, finding treasure, finding cursed items that you have to uncurse. And gradually they kind of added more things like different character classes that you would see in a traditional RPG, right? And NetHack was really the game that took all of this stuff and just added so much to it that it is a game you could play for literally years, decades even, and not see everything in the game. It was a really early example, and maybe still an unmatched example, of interactivity in a game, largely because all the interactivity is just like text on your screen, right? It's much easier to program the function of what happens if you pour a potion of oil on a squeaky board trap. Well, it stops squeaking. It's very easy to represent that in text. A lot more work to create all the graphics for it and everything you would need in like a modern 3D game, right?
Right.
So this game just has truly staggering degree of interactivity and things that can happen in it.
I mean, people can still play it today. Am I right in thinking that?
They can still play it today. Yeah, it's a free game. You can download it and play it on your computer. I don't know how many kilobytes it is, but it's not very many.
Pretty small, yeah.
But the kind of the main way I think most people play it is you use a little terminal application on your computer to connect to this server called nethack.alt.org that has been around at least since the early 2000s. They have a stat on the website that like we're closing in on 12 million games have been played of NetHack over the years. And this has my favorite, this is like my favorite thing about NetHack. So as you're going through the dungeon, every time you go down a floor, it, you know, procedurally generates a new floor for you. And who knows what monsters and traps you're going to run into, right? But there's a small chance when you load one of these floors that you will load a bones level, which is the level that another player on the server died on. And so then you will basically have entered their world and you can find their body, their corpse, with all of their stuff on it, which could be junk, but it could be incredible gear that will help you enormously in your own quest. Of course, the monster or whatever that killed them is also still around on the floor. So you know, like, you're in this very heightened state of danger, but also like opportunity for great reward. So yeah, it's a really exciting game. It's kind of hard to express how much is going on in this game because it looks so simple, right? But I mean, it just has like secrets, within mechanics, within features. You can dump a long sword into a fountain and there's a chance it'll turn into the Excalibur. You can polymorph into a dragon and lay an egg and that egg can hatch and then become your dragon pet. You can eat the meat of a cockatrice and stone yourself. That was like the worst death I ever had in this game, was I accidentally ate a cockatrice corpse and killed myself on a really good run. It's just a wild game that looks so simple, but they're still every few years adding new functionality to it, even though it's been sort of in on and off development now for slightly longer than I've been alive. Yeah,
incredible, right? NetHack. So yeah, so I mean, speaking of how long you've been alive, so you were born in the Northeast Georgia. Tell us about that. What was it like, your childhood?
Yeah, I grew up in the South. A lot of my family is in Atlanta, Georgia, which if you're not from the South, is probably the only city in Georgia that you really know by name. My parents moved out to the country, kind of wanted the quieter life. And so I grew up with, you know, a few close friends nearby, and my parents were involved in a really cool local art scene that was sort of the one bastion of liberalism in an otherwise overwhelmingly very conservative, very religious area, which it turns out I did not really take to. It was not for me so much, the Southern Baptists and stuff. So yeah, I struggled a bit with that, and really, as I got older, wanted to live anywhere else pretty much.
Right. Were your parents part of that that world of conservative sort of religious?
They weren't, thankfully. They did like want to go to church, just sort of more to give me an education in it than anything. But my parents weren't especially religious, didn't push that super hard, but it's kind of just everywhere around you. You know, I imagine there are pockets of England where that is the same.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not too comparable to the UK, I suppose. It's a sort of...
Different veins.
Yeah, I mean, it did different veins. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So were your parents professional artists then?
So my mom is a folk artist, which is basically an untrained artist, but she would paint and stuff. And she ran a gallery for many years at this local community center. And my dad has been a lifelong photographer, but also had an interesting career that really got me into technology early on. But back in the 80s and 90s and into the early 2000s, his main gig was going to all of these big work conventions, right? So like a big telecom company, you know, an AT&T or something, would be having their annual shareholders meeting. And back in the 90s, like, you would do all of this stuff in person, right? They weren't doing it over the internet. So they would bring everybody together for a week, do a ton of presentations on actual slide projectors, or early PowerPoint. And they needed somebody to run the computer that ran the slide projectors, run all of the wireless microphones, do all the audio mixing, all that stuff. And so my dad kind of fell into this career as a stage manager, where he would go and help set up all this gear and run all these big shows. And, you know, those jobs paid really, really well, but of course they were kind of irregular, you know, scattered around. So there'd be times where he'd, you know, be in one month, he'd be gone for 2 or 3 weeks, and then another month he'd be there the whole time. But, you know, he was always kind of a computer geek and had a lot of tech around.
Yeah, I was going to say, I bet he was very techy. So is that how you got introduced to video games, or computer games at least?
Yeah, really, definitely how I got introduced to computers. We had a couple computers when I was young, an old like 8086 IBM compatible, which is kind of the first generation of these types of personal computers that a lot of people use. And we would play some very janky old games on that thing. And then a few years later, he got a 386, which was massively faster by comparison. But that was kind of like the first era of computers where I was playing some games by myself, a lot of games with him, like some of the old Sierra or LucasArts Adventures games. You know, I had one called Conquest of Camelot, which was one of the few like non-Roberta and Ken Williams designed games from the Sierra lineage. But it was, you know, you play as King Arthur and you're going on the quest for the Grail, just a brutally hard game. Like, it would just kill you all the time. The puzzles like made no sense. It was really, really tough. But that was kind of how Sierra rolled with adventure games back then.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, we would play stuff like that together and try to puzzle our way through before we knew about internet walkthroughs.
Oh, lovely. Right, let's come to your second game then, Wes. So this is from 1996. So I'm guessing you were pretty young when you were playing this. So tell us about this game.
Yeah, this is Star Ocean for the Super Famicom. Full disclosure, I played this game quite a few years later after it came out, but this is an RPG for the Super Famicom or the Super Nintendo, made by Triace, a studio that Has made quite a few RPGs over the years, usually working with Enix, the studio behind like Dragon Quest. And this was like one of the last RPGs for the Super Nintendo, very late in that console's life cycle, so very advanced technologically for what the Super Nintendo could do. So it was one of those games where they kind of pulled out all the stops with the pixel art, really detailed like reflections in the water puddles, you know, like real fancy tech for 1996. Had like a 48 megabit cartridge, which probably cost, I don't know, like $100 or something in Japan. But it never came out over here in the US, I think largely because of that cost. And it also has like a voice acted opening sequence that is literally like verbatim from Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country. Very strange thing that they decided to rip off.
Really?
With, funny enough, starring Robert Belgrade, who voiced Alucard in Castlevania Symphony of the Night.
Right.
So some weird like pedigree to this game. But anyway, it didn't come out in the States. But it was fan translated in the early 2000s, and that was how I discovered it. And this was kind of an early game for me to start using. I discovered emulators and would like play Super Metroid, you know, in computer class in school, and was kind of wowed that I could play these Super Nintendo games. But I never owned a Super Nintendo, and I wasn't, I would say at this point, especially aware of just how many games that were developed in Japan were never released in the US. So this game was a real like eye opener for me, where I stumbled upon this fan translation. I don't really remember how. A friend of mine had played another RPG from this era, Tales of Phantasia, that also was never released in the US, but got a fan translation. So maybe it was through him that I discovered it, but this game kind of just blew my mind because it was so, it looked so good for a Super Nintendo game. It was not as good as a Final Fantasy, but it was sort of another one of those types of games that I didn't know there was sort of like a supply, a hidden supply out there, right? Of ones that I hadn't, you know, heard about and discovered yet.
Yeah, the Super Famicom, we should say, was a real breeding ground for these RPGs, particularly in Japan. I mean, there were so many classics running up to, you know, Final Fantasy 2 and 3 as they were in the West, and Chrono Trigger and all the rest. And as you say, there was a big community, wasn't there, of people translating these untranslated video games, doing it themselves, hacking into the game code, adding the English translations, and then releasing them as patches, right?
Yeah, that's the exact process. And, you know, a lot of the people doing this were not professional programmers. Some of them were, you know, college students figuring out how to do this stuff at a time when it wasn't especially well-documented, especially some of the early fan translations were like in the early 90s, right? So they were doing what seemed like magical work to fit English text into a Japanese game. There were a lot of challenges there. Like most of these games were designed in a way that Japanese text just kind of takes up less space, you know, visually on the screen. It's a denser language. And the way the text is sort of encoded when you're trying to replace the Japanese characters with English letters, they take up a lot of space because the font isn't designed to be variable width, where like a capital W should take up a lot more space than like a lowercase I, for example, right? But in a fixed width font, they take up the same amount of space. So it's very hard to fit English sentences into these games. So people really had to hack them and figure out how to change the code to be able to get these, you know, English versions of them out to people like me who wanted to play them. I didn't know any of this at the time, right? I just thought this game's super cool and was really excited about it. But that really kind of sparked a lifelong interest in emulators for me and fan translations. And I think to this day is probably the thing I still kind of get, I geek out the most over in games, is like hearing about this kind of long lost treasure that someone has taken upon themselves to spend 2 or 3 years of their life hacking it, taking it apart, translating it, putting it back together, and making it playable for people like me.
Yeah. Oh, it's so cool. I remember when I was young getting having an import copy of Bahamut Lagoon, this like strategy RPG game by Square Enix, a bit like Final Fantasy Tactics, but with dragons. And having printed off a translation from the internet and sort of sitting there leafing through it while trying to play the game. Very tragic.
How far did you get through? Did you make it to the end?
I didn't make it to the end, no. But I did persevere for a while. But it's really easy to get lost, obviously, because it's not linear dialogue or anything like that.
Just play this 40-hour game by flipping through 50 pages of text. Not an ideal way to experience the game, but I mean, I think you shared a similar passion to me, right? Of just finding out that game existed and that you know it was out there and there was a way for you to play it.
Yeah, it's so exciting.
Maybe not the ideal way to play it, but it was, you know, you wanted it bad enough and you went and got it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the analog in like music is finding an unreleased, you know, demo by a band that you love or something. I mean, it's not quite the same, or a film by a director that you love that was only released in one territory or something. So yeah, similar thing.
Yeah.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So when did you decide you wanted to become a writer?
That's a good question. Probably when I was quite young, though not initially in the kind of journalism path. When I was in middle school, I wrote at the time what I called a novel. Now I will refer to as a novella because I think it was probably about 100 pages or something, 120 pages. But I wrote this book called The Exile that was about like an elf character who gets framed for murder or something and has to go on like a quest to kill the evil orc or whatever. I loved the Warcraft strategy games by Blizzard Entertainment back in the 90s. They were these very formative real-time strategy games, but you know, all PC games back then would come with these manual booklets that were full of like cool art and lore, and especially Blizzard's games had these great sketches by artist Chris Metzen that were kind of all like pen and ink and just kind of dripping with like great, you know, fantasy character, right? So I basically just liberally took lore from the Warcraft games and just decided to kind of inject my own story into that throw some hobbits in from Lord of the Rings, right?
And yeah.
So it was just kind of, it was fantasy fan fiction, basically. But I wrote that, and then apparently that was the only creative writing I had in me to this day. Like, I've never done any more creative writing. That I just used it up and was kind of like, okay, like, I'm done with that. That's not really what I want to do.
Yeah.
But writing was kind of always my main interest in school. And that eventually kind of moved me towards like taking newspaper class in high school and then going to college for journalism. That was kind of, I never really had a backup plan. That was sort of just what I decided I wanted to do. And by the time I started reading gaming mags in my teens, I sort of was just like, okay, this is the job that I want to do. I want to write for one of these magazines or do this. And that eventually got me through college. And then I moved to San Francisco because that's where, at the time in the mid 2010s, that was still kind of, or this, I should say, was the place where a lot of the magazines were based and a lot of the websites were based. So it was sort of always the destination I had in mind, and I somehow managed to make it work.
Bit different to Georgia.
Yeah, quite a culture shock.
So the other end of this spectrum, I suppose, on the progressive, conservative continuum.
Absolutely, yeah. I had like a little bit of a prep for it in that going from Northeast Georgia, where it's very conservative, everybody is a Southern Baptist, basically, I went to college in Athens, Georgia, which is where the University of Georgia is. I think college towns kind of all over the world tend to skew more liberal, right? And Athens has a really famous music scene. It's where bands like Neutral Milk Hotel and REM came from. Some really great bands have come out of Athens over the years. So there's great music there. very, you know, liberal vibe in a state that was otherwise fairly conservative. And so once I got there, I was like, okay, like there's cool places here.
And relax
a little bit. And
felt like you fit, I guess it's more that, isn't it?
Yeah. And you know, I knew people who went to school who felt like they kind of got swallowed up at like a big university. It was like a 30,000 students when I was there. It's probably bigger than that now. It kind of was the city, and then Athens was sort of just around it. Whenever there was a football game, the whole city would just kind of have to like restructure how traffic flowed because so many people would be coming in from, you know, all over the state for these games. I could walk out of my dorm room and could tell whether we'd won or lost the game by like how trashed the hallway was. Like if it was, if it was kind of trashed, we'd probably won. But if it was like super trashed, we'd probably lost. And some people were taking their frustrations out. But on the whole, like a really fun place to go to school, and met a lot of cool people there and had a good time. And it was a good journalism school. And that got me on my way to San Francisco. Yeah.
Right, Wes, let's come to your third game then, which is from 2002. A little obscure, this one, but I'm excited to hear you talk about it. Tell us about this one.
Yeah. This game is Cubivore by a defunct Japanese developer named Saru Brune, I think is how you pronounce it. So they were sort of I don't know if Nintendo spinoff is quite the right word, but one of these companies that was sort of in orbit of Nintendo around the era when they were launching the GameCube, working on the Nintendo 64 DD, which I actually don't know much about. I don't know if you know your history, but
this is the disk drive.
It was like an add-on for the 64. Did that only come out in Japan? Is that right?
I believe so.
So there were like a few games being developed for this thing that were very much on the experimental side. And this was definitely one of them. So 2002, I was in high school. This was a period where I was really getting into games, getting into Nintendo games. I was like ungodly excited for Super Smash Brothers Melee and the launch of the GameCube. And this is a game that extremely implausibly I found on the shelf at my local like movie rental store, and like not even the bigger local movie rental store, but like the small one that I almost never went to. But I think one of my friends, like they would go to that one. And so we went there and I saw this game and I was like, what the hell is this?
How did this get here?
It's still like, I would love to go back and speak to the owner of that store and be like, who ordered Cubivore for the GameCube and why was it on your shelf? But yeah, just a fascinatingly weird game. I'll try to explain it. The setup is you're this very little cube creature in sort of this jungle Sahara setting, and you go around eating other creatures to grow stronger, and you're literally like tearing the kind of cube chunks off of their bodies to kind of put them on yourself to like grow an extra limb because you ripped it off another animal. And you're basically trying to become like the king of the jungle, the top animal of the food chain.
Right.
But through this very strange cubist presentation with this like surreal, not voiceover, but like text narration that reflects your inner monologue, you know, it'll be like, I'm born, I am alive, and like, I want to eat, and like just reflecting sort of tutorializing the game, but also lending it this very strange feeling of like, is this really me? Like, am I journaling my private thoughts, you know, about being the animal leader of the cube Sahara? It's just very strange presentation for this game.
Very cool. And so were you playing that with anyone else, or is it just you said you went to get it, hire it with your friend? Was it something you were exploring together?
Yeah, the first time I played it was a friend and I, and we definitely had the reaction that I think probably a lot of 16-year-olds would have playing a game like this in the early 2000s, where we were just laughing at it. We thought it was so bizarre. We're just like, you know, what the hell is this game? It's very silly. It's very surreal. And I think we didn't think too much of it at the time. Like, it was pretty, I had like a good time playing it, but I don't think we got too far. We were definitely laughing at it more than anything. I mean, it has some very funny like stat points where you level up like your hump points and your horn points and your tongue points. And of course, you mate to carry on your lineage, and then your cube animal dies and you become your spawn, your new
offspring. Right, yeah.
So like the first time I played it, I definitely thought of it as a curiosity more than anything, just sort of had a laugh. But it stuck with me for just because it was like nothing else I'd ever played, really. And a few years after that, when I was getting more into emulation on my PC, and there was an emulator that could actually play GameCube games. And so I revisited it and played all the way through it. And it really like kind of became one of my favorite games. Is maybe a bit strong, but like it still stands as absolutely one of the most unique games I've ever played. It's totally appreciate it. Yeah.
Yeah. That era in the early 2000s, there were a lot of those kind of games, particularly coming out of Japan, weren't there, that were just really, I suppose that's around the time Katamari Damacy comes out, and
yeah,
some quite offbeat, left field, almost sort of art schooly games being made at that time, weren't
there? Yeah. I think why this game really stuck with me is I played it shortly after I played Animal Crossing. Which has probably come up on this podcast before, but that, you know, this life simulation game that really, became obsessed with Animal Crossing. It really blew me away. I had never played a game that was this open-ended life sim before that didn't have, you know, sort of classic video game objectives, right? And you could just live in this world. And Cubivore is like more of a gamey game, but I think it was sort of a 1-2 punch for me of realizing, like, okay, beyond my initial reaction of this is so weird, I've never played anything like it, just how much creativity and interesting design there was under the surface of this game. And something I learned much later is the creator of this game, Gento Matsumoto, apparently he was like somewhat friends with Shigeru Miyamoto. I don't know what kind of relationship they had exactly. He also did a stint in jail for some kind of like traffic related fines. I think he was maybe driving without a license for so long that the Japanese government just locked him up for a while.
Well, at least they weren't animal related crimes. That would have been
yeah, nothing too bad. Just, you know,
nothing out of the game.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, just a really unique game that I hope gets really re-released someday because it's kind of lost to time if you don't own a very expensive copy of it. But really fun.
Right. Well, the campaign for Cubivore 2 starts here then on PC Gamer, I guess.
I would absolutely back that. Yeah.
So tell me how you landed the role at PC Gamer then. So you've been freelancing for a while at these I guess mainly PC hardware sites and covering that kind of thing. And then, yeah, you're in San Francisco. Where did you hear about the job?
Yeah, it was really a blessing of just kind of several people I've met over the course of my career. Both, you know, friends and professional have really just kind of been relationships that came in clutch at the right time. When I first moved to San Francisco, it was because I was a freelancer, largely writing for the site Tested that you mentioned, which is still around. They're more of a video presence now, but a really cool site that was at the time devoted to technology. And they were the sister site of Giant Bomb, which, you know, is a legendary video game personality site. And this was all kind of at the early days of that happening. They were spinning up Tested and they were doing kind of a mix of like maker culture coverage, which is what eventually drew Adam Savage to become like the kind of the owner, the head of the site, formerly of Mythbusters. But in the early days, we were writing just a lot about, you know, smartphones were, this was like a very exciting time for smartphones. They're still pretty new, right? There was all kinds of development happening there and PC hardware and stuff. So I was kind of like the newsboy for a few years just as a freelancer. And through that, one of the editors of Tested was a former PC Gamer editor for many years, Norman Chan. And through him, I met Evan Lottie, who is the current editor-in-chief of PC Gamer, has been there for many, many years. So I had known Evan for a couple years before they were hiring for a new editor based here in San Francisco. And he said, are you interested in this job? Would you like this job? I think you'd be good for it. And I said, absolutely, I would love to do it. And, you know, did an interview and got the job And that was kind of my...
Do you remember what they asked you for the interview? What you had to do?
Oh, man, what I have to do? I don't think there was a writing test or anything. I mean, I had samples that I could send. I'd been doing so much freelancing at that time.
Did your Warcraft novella?
I did not submit The Exile for consideration. I think that would have probably spiked the job opportunity. But yeah, I mean, at the time we were really sort of gearing up to become more of a big web presence. And, you know, I remember it kind of shows how much the team has changed since then. I remember being fairly adamant that I didn't want to do news, and that wasn't really what the position was based on. And I think then there were kind of some more clearly defined roles of the difference between a news and a feature that was kind of largely driven by the site design at the time and kind of old style magazine way of thinking about how you put together a site. You know, features are a big production. News is its own separate little thing that's not that important. And news is so valuable for us now. And so many people on the team kind of just naturally are expected to write a story about a new game they're interested in or a beat that they have expertise in. Or, you know, like it's not a thing where we just have a couple people who write news and that's all they do, and a few people who never ever touch news. You know, if you know a beat like emulation, if you know a beat like, you know, roguelikes or simulation games or whatever, and there's something within your realm, like, you should write about it. And it's okay for that thing you write to only be a few hundred words and take you half an hour. There's a good chance that 50 times more people want to read that story than something that you spent, you know, a month working on, right? So I still have the privilege of getting to work on some of that bigger stuff, but it's a very different kind of mix than it was when I applied. But yeah, back then I was definitely pitching. I've always appreciated sort of the legacy of a brand, and I've been more interested in upholding something like PC Gamer being this publication that people have known and trusted for many, many years over my own name being the thing that drew people to the site. I was always kind of cognizant of that, especially in that era when that was sort of when Twitch and YouTube were really blowing up when I joined in 2014. So it was kind of a shifting moment of more and more things being personality driven. And I wanted people to read what I wrote and, you know that I wrote it, but I was happy for them to come for the story and not come for me, which is it's tricky in the modern era of journalism to, I don't know, have job security for the rest of your career while not necessarily like making your personality the big driving force. I'm curious how you feel about that as someone who spent many years as a freelancer and, you know, you run your own podcast now. Like, was doing this podcast largely because you just wanted something that you wholly owned that you could have your name on?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's part of it. Yeah, I mean, you know, that thing you're talking about, the personalities, that's definitely feels like more of a US journalism thing, games journalism, and maybe not entirely, but that was certainly, you know, when I was mainly freelancing about games, that was my sense, is that the Americans really put themselves forward. And I don't know, in the UK, we've been less eager to do that, perhaps in some ways, or certainly in my circle, those were the conversations we were having. But yeah, I mean, I guess so. I just wanted to talk to interesting people and sort of build up a bit of an oral history of these early decades of games, I suppose. That was my thinking.
I think for me, like, one of the reasons I started doing my emulation newsletter, Read Only Memo, is like, I just wanted to give myself, really push myself to go and track down a lot more sources that I could kind of go to whenever there's news, just talk to more people that... I write about this stuff at PC Gamer occasionally, but the kind of the scope of a story that is required to be worth spending, you know, real job time on at PC Gamer in these kind of niche hobby interests is like, it has to pass a pretty high threshold, right? Whereas if I'm just writing about something I think is cool myself, I can just go into a Discord with some people working on a cool hack or something and just send them a message. And, you know, those people are usually very excited to talk about the thing that they're working on, you know. So that kind of pushed me out of my comfort zone a little bit of talking, you know, to people for these bigger stories and communicating with PR and be like, no, I should actually just be talking to more people doing cool stuff that like 100 people in the world, you know, are following right now, and bring that to a little bit bigger audience.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the economics of writing reported features around games is something I'm sure we talk about for an hour, and how that's basically impossible and has been for some time. But
it's really tough. Yeah,
yeah. We should probably not go down that that rabbit hole. Okay, why don't we come to your fourth game then, Wes? And yeah, this is a classic actually from 2002. Tell us about this one.
Yeah, this is Breath of Fire Dragon Quarter. The last game with an asterisk, there was one failed mobile game in the Breath of Fire series, a really unique game. I don't know if anyone on the podcast has talked about this before.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, but so this game took what was kind of a conventional Japanese RPG series from Capcom, always sort of in the shadow of Final Fantasy, never a huge breakout, but a fun RPG series on the Super Famicom and on the PlayStation. And this game just took it in a totally unexpected direction. I'm realizing there's a bit of a common theme here with my interest in NetHack with Dragon Quarter, because this was a game that was actually kind of an early roguelike, I guess, in terms of kind of taking RPGs and making them replayable in interesting ways. It's this game where you play a character who's kind of like a lowly, kind of like a grunt worker in this post-apocalyptic underground society, and your buddy is kind of like a higher class worker than you, and he's constantly giving you shit for being like a worthless, you know, like you're a D level or something like that, and he just doesn't think you're worth anything, basically. And then, you know, in classic like RPG trope fashion, you form a connection with this dragon that gives you superpowers in the game, and you become much more powerful, and you go on this quest to kind of save this girl who's been like genetically engineered and abused, and you're like, I'm going to get her to the surface where we think there will be clear skies, and we'll get out of this dystopian hellscape that we live in. But the really interesting twist of this game is you can use these dragon powers and just absolutely flatten any enemy that you fight in the game. Any boss battle, you can just end it in like a turn. But every time you use these powers, you increase this meter quite rapidly, that once it hits 100%, you basically go full dragon form, and it's like game over. Basically, you've died, you have lost control. And so the game is built around this idea of saving in very specific spots. It only lets you save the game a few times, but you can then basically try to kind of min-max your way through it by going crazy with the dragon form, killing everything, using a mechanic that lets you restart but retain some of the kind of levels and like experience you've gotten, and then replay it. And as you play the game multiple times, it like opens up new story branches and you see cutscenes that you didn't see before. And it just becomes this game that like at first is just brutally, unforgivingly hard and like very tedious, but then has these moments of like incredible catharsis where you're just like, oh, these, you know, these enemies that I've been like slugging my way through for the last hour, like screw it, I'm just gonna go dragon form and just like, you know, absolutely level them in 5 seconds and feel really good about it.
Oh, so cool. Yeah, I mean, such a mechanically interesting game, as you say, and so that's such a unique way of storytelling that is unique to video games, right? You couldn't do that in any other medium where you sort of
absolutely
have to, like, you know, lose the story in a sense in order to then regenerate and start again with a better chance. That's something that we can only see in games. Yeah.
I mean, it's almost like a game version of the Tom Cruise movie Edge of Tomorrow, right? Except you feel it so much more intensely because you're the one actually playing it, and you get to see all these other narrative possibilities in the game. Do you remember when this game came out and sort of, it had quite a good critical reception, I think, but I think a lot of fans of this series were very divided over it because it was so different.
Yeah, I do. I do remember. I think I owned a copy, but I haven't thought about it in many years until you mentioned it. And you describing it there is definitely made me want to go and play it again. So,
you know, it was kind of a similar experience for me, where even kind of similar to Cubivore, where it was a game that I played at the time and did think was quite cool, but didn't really get very far in it because I think it was just a little bit too complicated. I kind of didn't wrap my head fully around the system of how you could restart the game from a save point and be stronger rather than having to like completely restart the game. So I kind of got frustrated with it and put it aside. And only recently have kind of tried to pick it up for like the third time a few months ago and played all the way through it and absolutely loved it. So it's a game that I would recommend, you know, read some guides about it if you're not precious about, you know, kind of spoiling yourself a little for the mechanics, but it takes a bit to understand things that the game does not do a great job of explaining to you that it tries to explain. It just isn't great at doing so. And once you wrap your head around that stuff, it's a really special experience.
So you've talked a little bit about how there's been lots of layoffs in the media industry around video games. I'm guessing that you have some friends and peers that have lost their jobs in the last 12 months or so. Is that
definitely
is that true? How's that been to be one of the people, I guess, who still has a position, you know, secure, however secure that might be, but you still have a job? How's that been to see some of that happening around you?
Yeah, I mean, I've known people in kind of both in the tech as well as the media world who've gotten laid off. One thing about being in San Francisco is you sort of see the crossover of all of those industry layoffs, right? I mean, Facebook and Google and these big companies have laid off tens of thousands of people apiece, or at least, you know, thousands. I think the sort of driving force in my view of how these companies work and how these layoffs have worked and kind of where the economy is at has really been shaped by, I don't know, becoming more and more like radicalized the last few years by the political landscape of the US. And 10 years ago, if a company did layoffs, I probably would have assumed like they needed to do layoffs or kind of taken for granted how the financial system worked. These days, I look at it and my reaction is always like, why are the people who get to lay off, you know, all of these workers making 10 times their salaries or 100 times their salaries? And also they're the ones who made the decision to hire 5,000 people during, you know, the economic boom of COVID without giving any thought to the possibility that like the economy could slow down at some point. You know, we do have actually some history of seeing economies go up and down. It's not always a mountain going straight up. But I think so many companies just operate on this principle of if the number's going up, let's assume it's going to always go up and just spend money freely. And then we'll just, you know, shit can people as soon as there's a sign that we're not going to make as much profit as we were. So I really feel like most of it is needless. And I look at people in the media industry getting laid off and I don't think like, not only is it not their fault, but it is a failure of the people who run these companies to both care about their employees as much as they should. I think the whole system is broken when they care more about shareholders than they do employees. And of course, that is like the financial law of the land that you care more about shareholders. So I think it's all broken. And I could rant about it for a long time, but it gives me at least some comfort that, you know, if I do my job well, the only thing I have to worry about is stuff that's outside my hands. You know, these big media layoffs could just cut a bunch of people who were doing incredible work, and it's not down to the quality of the journalism. It's just the unfortunate reality of how the business world works these days. So maybe that shouldn't be comforting. I don't know. Maybe that should be horrifying and keep me awake at night, but sort of just look at it and I'm just disgusted with the whole thing.
Yeah.
Not to be a downer, but...
No, not at all. No, I think that's... we don't often get to hear from people, I suppose, who are close to these detonations happening. So it's good to hear your perspective. Right, time is marching on, so we better come to your fifth game, Wes. Why don't you tell us about your last game here?
Yeah, speaking of downers, this is Nier from 2010. A game by a small, now defunct studio called Kavya that made a series of games called Drakengard before this. Best known for the creator of Drakengard and Nier, Yoko Taro, as one of the... I don't even know how to describe Yoko Taro. Certainly one of the most colorful characters in the video game business. Have you ever interviewed him by any chance?
No, I haven't, but he's quite, eccentric, right? He wears this... He often wears this big helmet sort of mask... which is based on one of the characters from Nier, right?
Yeah, it's like a sort of a big moon-looking skull with a giant smile, like very creepy smile, which is one of the characters from Nier. Yeah, so this is a game that it's like an action RPG from the Xbox 360 era. There are two versions of this game, but the one that I played and the one that I love, you play as the dad of this young girl. As opposed to the other version, you're her brother, and so the relationship is a little bit different. I just love the writing in this game. The tone of this game has an incredible soundtrack. It's one of those kind of classic 7 out of 10 video games that is bursting with ideas, but is kind of held back by its budget and like some janky elements. But I think the more games like this I've played, the more I realize like I love a game that has some rough edges to it, right? They're so much more memorable often than a game that's just perfect and had unlimited time and money to,
that's true.
To shine off all of the flaws. This game has just such a weird mix of stuff you do in it. You know, it's okay third-person action combat, but then there's a section that becomes just a text adventure on the screen. There's sort of like a kind of a horror mystery portion of the game. It has this fascinating narrative structure where you finish the game, you sort of get this bad, unsatisfying ending, but then it restarts you at about the halfway point of the game and you can replay for another 4 hours or so, 6 hours, get to the end again. You get to kind of see some more of the story play out, and you go through that process 3 or 4 times, I think, before you've kind of seen the full story. Yeah, just a weird game. Has some great character dynamics between. There's this character in your party named Kane, who's this really angry woman, and then there's a magic book that's your companion called Vice, and they're like constantly shouting at each other. Have you played this old version of Nier? Because I know there's been a remake some more people have played.
I don't think I did. I played the much more well-known and successful sequel, right? Automata. But
Automata, which is also a great game. And so, in my opinion, somewhat tragically, when they remade this original Nier, which came out maybe 2 or 3 years ago, they remade the other version of it where you play as the brother of the character instead of the dad.
Oh, I see.
And I really prefer the dad character, who's just kind of this like, he kind of has this over the hill energy to him. He's sort of morose, like very caring, loves his daughter, but it's just not a character you play in games very often. I guess it's become more common with games like The Last of Us, and there's sort of this like sad dad genre, exactly, God of War. But Nier is a very different kind of sad dad than I mean, this is a little bit reductive, but I think the games like Last of Us and God of War, they feel like these games where the lead developer was in their 20s or 30s and then hit their 40s, became a dad, and all of a sudden, like, they're like, I have to make a game with this new worldview.
Right.
That is not the game that Nier is. No. You know, Yoko Taro is, I do not think, a dad, but if he is, I'm sure he's a very weird dad. And at the time he made this game, that was not the personality of this game. So,
right.
Just a strange experience. It's an early, maybe not early, but it's a translation by 8-4, which is a great translation group in Japan. And the very first thing you hear when you put this disc in your Xbox 360 console and boot it up, like on a black screen as it's loading in, is the character Kane shouting, "Vice, you dumbass!" And like, that is your like flavor setting for this game before you've seen anything. It's just like so abrupt and jarring and funny. So I love this game, just so much personality to it.
Pretty stuff. Right, Wes, let's go through your five games. We have got here NetHack. We've got the original Star Ocean, Cube of War, Breath of Fire, Dragon Quarter, and Nier brackets, the sad dad version.
Exactly. Very important. Do not play the brother version. Play the sad dad version if you know it's good for you.
Right. Really great console. Yeah, we need a name for this to market it to the world. Have you thought at all about what we could call your console?
You know, before I was coming on the show a few days ago, I was thinking, I got to have a name for this thing or else I'm going to panic in the moment. And then I completely forgot. So I've got nothing. My mind goes back to the fact that the name for NetHack was literally, they added net to it because it was a game that you shared over an early network. And at the time, that was extremely novel. So I don't know, like the NetCube or something, the net quarter. I don't know. We'll just throw net on one of these game names. And
okay. NetCube sounds good. Let's go with that. Right. Cool. Before I let you go then, Wes. Yeah. I mean, just slightly returning to the last point that we were talking about, the layoffs and the games media industry becoming smaller. I guess one of the side effects of that is that there's just fewer opportunities for young writers wanting to come in and write about games.
Uh-huh.
What advice might you give someone listening to this who wants to try and take that rather difficult path, perhaps, but a noble one nonetheless? How might they pitch to you, for example?
Man, I mean, for starters, like, I would love some advice on that myself, because I think, I mean, we're going through, I think, one of the biggest times of change in the internet since I've used it, you know, in the last 20-25 years. We're seeing all these social networks sort of crumble and new ones trying to take their place, and I don't know how all of that is going to play out. And as we see, you know, big media companies like Vice kind of falling apart as well, I think we maybe are returning to a time when people are building their own websites more and kind of splintering off into smaller communities. And I don't know if that is going to be a path towards building a career, but I'm hopeful that it is maybe better for our mental health a little bit than the monolithic social platforms. And maybe it does become sort of a new era of the, you know, we kind of went through like the blog boom, you know, in the late 2000s, I guess, where a lot of smaller sites grew quite large, you know, the Joysticks and the Engadgets of the world and the Kotakus of the world, right? The Gawker Media. Those were not always legacy companies. They were small companies that got some great writers together and became big. So I think being optimistic, maybe start your own thing, band together with a few people. Maybe there are more opportunities for these smaller pockets of the internet to kind of form new pillars. In terms of the big sites like ours, like I hope we can hold on. We still make a magazine, which is a thing that some people like to read. So I think we're going to be around for a while. But you can always, you know, send me an email, Wesley PC Gamer, and that's easy. And just have...
And can people pitch you?
Yeah, people can pitch me for sure. You're going to have more luck if you have stuff to link me to that you've already written. You know, it doesn't matter if it's on an established website, you know, like just spin up a WordPress blog and write what you think is good stuff. I think the biggest tip I can give, even though this sounds very simple to anyone pitching me or really any game site is just read the site and try to identify what the tone and the style of that site is. Try to identify what they have and haven't written about and where you could offer them something that they either don't have or, you know, feels very complimentary to the stuff on the site. Like, so often, I think for young writers, you're pitching just the thing that you want to write that you're excited about. And it's good to be excited about it, for sure. You should be passionate about what you're writing about. But, you know, the website is less interested in what you're excited about as they are you writing something that fits their audience, that fits their voice, right? So if you're just like, I want to write, you know, 5,000 words about this subject that I am very excited about, like, make sure that you're pitching that to an outlet that is a fitting piece of material for. Otherwise, they're probably going to say, you know, have fun. That's not for us. Like, have a good day. So just know your audience, know your site, and that'll take you pretty far, I think.
Yes, indeed. Brill. Well, thanks so much for your time, Wes. It's been great to meet you and to hear your picks, and I really appreciate it. And all the best with everything as you go forward for the rest of the year.
Thanks so much for having me, Simon. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much to my guest, Wes Fenlon. What a treat that was. What a lovely guy Wes is. It was, just absolutely loved hearing his game choices, his passion coming through there. He and I share quite similar tastes in certainly some of these what would be considered more obscure Japanese role-playing games. We certainly seem to have played similar games at similar times in our lives. So, I felt very connected to Wes's list there. Thank you. Thank you to him as well for bearing with me, because we did have this chat a little while ago. You may have noticed at the start of that conversation, there were quite a few references to Starfield, the really big American role-playing game from the Oblivion Elder Scrolls team in America. That was one of the big games at the end of 2023. And so you can see just sort of how quickly the world moves on, because no one's really talking about Starfield anymore. But anyway, that's why there were a few references to that. So thank you to Wes for hanging on for the right spot. I felt coming after Jack Thompson last week, we could use a little pick-me-up and a little celebration of what video games are from someone who works for such a wonderful outlet as PC Gamer. So yeah, it was great to hear that. I have actually been working with Wes as well recently. So as I've mentioned before on the podcast, I help out with the editing and commissioning for the independent games magazine, A Profound Waste of Time. It is a very, very beautiful magazine, the highest of high quality that you can imagine. It's the first and, in my opinion, the best of the sort of new crop of luxury games magazines, coffee table mags. And yeah, it's just one issue a year, which is testament to the creative director and founder of A Profound Waste of Time, Caspian Whistler. It's testament to the care and attention he lavishes on it. Anyhow, Wes has written a piece for the forthcoming issue that will be out later this year. He's written all about the world of fan translation, and particularly has based it on the character of a very well-regarded, renowned fan translator called Hilltop. Perhaps his best known game that he translated recently was Racing Lagoon, which is a car racing role-playing game for the PlayStation made by Square Enix, or Squaresoft actually at the time it was. Very cool sort of street racing game set in Yokohama in the suburbs of Tokyo, and Hilltop was decided to translate this rather kooky little PlayStation game and put it out into the world. And anyway, that's the sort of basis of Wes's piece. So if you'd like to read that, then head to apwot, that's apwot.com, and you will be able to order a copy of the forthcoming issue 4, in which Wes's article will appear. I've also worked on a piece for that, a long piece talking to many of the people who worked on Portal 2. If you loved Portal 2, then you should pick that up as well. I've spoken to many of the team, including former guest of the show, Eric Walpaw, who was one of the writers and also Jay Pinkerton, a fantastic comedy writer. The two of them wrote the script and wrote all the lines for Wheatley, who was played by Stephen Merchant. If you're a sort of UK comedy nerd, or in fact, Stephen Merchant's pretty global now, isn't he? Then, yeah, you may remember he voiced the character of Wheatley in that game. Anyway, loads of details in that. Back to Wes anyway. So it was nice to hear Wes, it wasn't nice to hear Wes, but it was important to hear Wes talk, I think, about the effect that layoffs in the media industry, with particular regard to video game publications, has had on many of the workers who work in that space. And since I spoke to Wes, there have been just continued ongoing waves of layoffs. Most recently, the editorial director of Kotaku, that website, has handed in her notice because the sort of investment company that took that over, that outlet over, has decided to pivot to just producing huge numbers of guides. No shade on the people who write guides, of course, but Kotaku is, you know, been known for breaking stories and for its serious news stuff as well. You know, it's got its fans, it's got its detractors, but it's an important piece of the video game media landscape, undeniably. And so it's sad to see like another one entering these difficulties. So yeah, interesting to hear Wes talk about that from his perspective as someone who is still very much at the coalface in that industry, covering games for one of the big outlets based in America. Right, so we are now into our April run of guests. If you'd like to see who's coming up through April, why not become a Patreon supporter? It would be much appreciated if you did. It's about the cost of a magazine. It really does help. We've got like a really lovely community of Patreon supporters. You'll get to be part of that. You get various benefits. But yeah, like I say, for about the cost of a magazine, it helps just keep the podcast going. It's a lot of work goes into these. It's not just, you know, a lot of podcasts are just a couple of people sitting around chatting. Nothing wrong with those. I love those podcasts. But, you know, there's quite a lot goes into producing one of these episodes. So it just helps it all keep going. Head to patreon.com/myperfectconsole. You can read about who the guests are coming up this month. You can also take part in My Perfect Game of the Month, which is a new feature that we've been running. Last month, we were all playing together the game Factorio, which was a choice by Final Fantasy director Yoshinori Kitase on the podcast. We all played that, and then there's a special episode that I made with a friend of the podcast, Glenn Moore, the comedian, and we chatted about our experiences playing that. That's an episode that's exclusive to the Patreon supporters. And so, yeah, why don't you join up and you can listen to that. This month, we are playing through the game Steven's Sausage Roll. This was one of the choices from my guest, Patrick House, the neuroscientist and writer. Patrick spoke about this game, which he described, I think, as being an almost, or if not perfect, puzzle game. It came out in 2016. It was developed and published by Incrapare Games, which and the designer of it was Stephen Lavelle, and that's why it's called Steven's Sausage Roll. It came out in 2016. It did very, very well at the time. It's got a 9 out of 10 in Edge magazine, 8 out of 10 in Game Informer. The Guardian gave it 5 stars out of 5 stars, and it actually won PC Game of the Year in the Edge Awards 2016. All of that said, I don't know how widely played the game is today, or how well remembered it is. Perhaps you are big into your PC puzzlers and you know all about it. But I think maybe, you know, there are probably quite a few people who haven't played it. I am, in fact, one of them. But so, yeah, we're going to be playing through that Steven's Sausage Roll. It's available on PC. You can buy it direct from, well, you can buy it on Steam, of course, but you can also buy it direct from Steven if you just go to the website. If you type into Google Steven Sausage Roll buy, and it'll come up there. I think it's about £20, which is, you know, not nothing, but it is a very, very good video game by all accounts. And of course, if you want to hear more about it, go and listen to Patrick House's episode. Yeah, get stuck in, enjoy the game, see what you make of it, and then at the end of April, Glenn and I will be releasing another episode where we talk about that and our experiences, where we got stuck and what we enjoyed, etc., etc. Anyway, something a bit different. And then, yeah, we'll have another game again in May. Right, next week, we have got an exciting BAFTA special episode. So, my guest is Siobhan Reddy. Siobhan is the BAFTA deputy chair. She is also studio director at Media Molecule. That is the Guildford-based studio that's behind Little Big Planet, the designers of Sackboy, and sort of one of the mascots of Sony PlayStation. If you very recognisable character there, and Siobhan has got a long and storied history working in the games industry and also working for BAFTA. The reason we're doing a BAFTA special is because, of course, it's the BAFTA Games Awards happening in early April, the week that the episode will come out. Rather excitingly, friend of the podcast, previous guest Phil Wang is the presenter of the Video Game BAFTAs this year. You can tune in, I think, and watch it live, probably on YouTube or on BAFTA's website. You'll figure it out and see what I'm sure Phil has got some excellent material for presenting the BAFTAs. And it'll be fun to see who the winners are. My bets are on Baldur's Gate 3. I think it's going to clean up. But we'll see. Watch this space. So yeah, join me again next week with Siobhan, with her five games and with one more perfect console.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.